Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Gates. This season, we're talking about 7 Labs, 1 Erdc. I'm Annette Kirkland. Discover the power of Erdc's 7 laboratories as they bring their technical expertise together to solve the nation's toughest challenges, from developing technologies that support the warfighter to improving the civil work systems we rely on each day. See how each of these 7 labs play a unique role in engineering a safer, better world. Today, I've got 2 guests with me today from the Environmental Lab, otherwise known as EL. I have with me Dr. Elizabeth Ferguson. She's Lead Technical Director, Installations and Operational Environments, Senior Scientific Manager. And Dr. Jan Sider-Mosier, she's Technical Director, Civil Works, Senior Scientific Technical Manager. I think I got all that. Did I get all that right, ladies?
You did. I think so.
Okay, good morning. How are y'all this morning?
Good morning.
Good. So glad to have you here. And we're going to start off with the best question. Let's learn about you guys. Let's start off with, could you tell me about yourselves, your background, and explain your roles at EL?
You want me to go first?
Sure.
Okay. So this is Elizabeth. So my background is pretty broad. I wandered around in college. Had no idea what I really wanted to do when I grew up.
I could see you wandering around, by the way.
I was. My backpack, you know, just kind of like, where am I now? But I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I had these thoughts. I kind of was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to med school or something like that. And then I didn't do that. So I was getting my, I dual majored in psychology and chemistry. And I always said, because people are like, okay, those are 2 very different things. I wanted to understand, you know, how the chemicals felt when they were bonding. But, you know, that really bad joke aside, I started working in neuropsych and I was working with lab rats. And the professor that I had for my chemistry undergraduate seminar class had this project. And he's like, hey, you know, I've got funding for you. Do you want to come get your master's degree? I was like, sure, why not? You know, I don't have anything better to do right now. And I have no idea what I want to do.
For some reason, I could find something better to do than that, but okay.
So this project was looking at transdermal absorption of drugs using radioanalytical techniques. So I started working in the radioanalytical labs in the chemistry department and got my master's in radioanalytical and nuclear chemistry. And then I got out and I had no idea what I was
going
to do with
still
my
wondering.
Life.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, still got to be a grown up, still got to pay the bills one day. What am I going to do? And I met this professor, Wesley Burge, and he was one of the top guys doing all the testing for aquatic toxicology for the EPA. And I was like, oh, all right. Well, this is kind of interesting. I love to be around water. And so that just was fascinating to me. And he said, okay, so there's this new professor coming in. He's coming in from Sweden and he needs some students straight up. You're interested in water. He's a fish physiologist by training and doing aquatic toxicology. So why don't we merge you guys together and see if you get along? And Krister Hogstrand and I got along great. So I got my PhD then in aquatic toxicology. Fish physiology and aquatic toxicology.
Bet you can't say that 5 times real fast.
It's the fish physiology that trips you up every single time. I mean, it's part of the degree that you got to be able to say that fast.
Right, exactly.
And so it was really exciting work, and I got to be out on the water all the time, really looking at, you know, what types of impacts different contaminants had on fish and other critters that are around the streams and lakes and so on. And I absolutely loved it. And then I got out and I was like, okay, now I got to get a job in this because, you know, fish physiologists are not in high demand, really. I mean, I think there's like 10 in the world. And so anyway, I was looking for jobs and then one just popped up with the Corps of Engineers in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was for a chemist/risk assessor. And I was like, oh, okay, well, risk assessment, you're looking at the toxic impacts of, you know, what's going on. This sounds really exciting, but there was a human aspect to it as well, I think. And I didn't really know the human aspect as well. So, but I went in and I got the job and I worked there for 5 years and it was so much fun. Mm-hmm. I was working in military engineering. We were doing all the cleanups of the bases that were being closed or reallocated to other federal entities. And so doing all the sampling and really trying to understand what was going on in the environment. It was really important when I went to the resident advisory boards and other meetings with the Corps that the environment around those installations be preserved. Mm-hmm. The people around were like, okay, so yes, we understand we want any contaminants gone, we want any threats gone, but at the same time, we don't want you to take out the entire ecosystem either. And when you do a cleanup, that's what happens. So I got to work really closely with state and federal EPAs, Fish and Wildlife Service, and all these different entities to try and understand exactly what was going on those installations and what we really needed to do to clean them up and to make it so that it was safe for everybody and no matter what that installation became in its future. So I did start doing a lot of really research and studies, mm-hmm. and that led me to ERDC.
Yay!
And so I actually came to ERDC as a temporary employee. I was the branch,
like a detail?
Yeah, okay. As an acting branch chief for the risk branch.
Okay.
And so I enjoyed that for about 9 months and decided that people and facilities management was just not my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as close to the research as I wanted it to be. And so I had to find another pathway. And luckily, they opened up this associate technical director job with the current technical director. And it was just, you know, making sure that I was his right hand and understood what he was doing. Because they were like, okay, he's going to retire one day and we want some succession planning. Mm-hmm. And did that. And I just fell in love because I got to be a part of all of these different research projects. And because I had this really wild background of all sorts of different things, that just suited me just wonderfully. I just really enjoyed grabbing in and saying, okay, this is really fun research and being part of that leadership team. So getting that opportunity was amazing. And then eventually when John moved on to another job and I got to move up into the technical director's role, I was like, oh, I'm staying here forever. You're not getting rid of me now.
Right.
So, you know, 20-some years later, here I am,
there
still
you
at
go.
ERDC and leading the installations and operational environments. And, you know, it really is my happy place.
Right. I can tell. I love that story. Okay, Jan?
All right. Boy, that's a tough act to follow. So, yeah, I am a soil scientist by background, so I don't know that it can get much different from Elizabeth. So I ended up going into soil chemistry because I thought that it might be a more marketable field than being a kind of like you're talking about being a fish physiologist. A pedologist is kind of a little bit of a niche field where not a lot of folks, maybe that skill isn't as needed. So I was like, well, I'll be more marketable if I add chemistry to my background. And so I did that. And my grad school is a little different. I studied poultry litter, which if anybody knows about that is not.
What is that?
I don't know if we're allowed to say poop on the radio, but yes.
Okay, you just did.
Yes, I did. But it was land applications of agricultural amendments and things of that nature for fertilizer purposes. But looking at different compounds within that and how it interacts in the soil. So, but I was able to acquire some very unique skill sets, and some folks actually reached out to me that I knew, and they said, hey, you know, there's this really great place in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and they do really great research, and they need somebody with your skill set. And I'm like, and I'm from upstate New York, so that's, I was like, Mississippi? I'm like, I don't know about that, but came to interview, and I was very impressed, and loved Vicksburg, loved the facilities. And I said, well, sure, I can do anything for 2 or 3 years, and here I am. 16, 17 years later, still here. So I started here as a researcher doing environmental soil chemistry, and I actually worked with Elizabeth as a PI or researcher, principal investigator. I would say PI is what that means. And then after quite a few years doing that, went into supervisory work where I was able to work more on the civil works side. So in case people don't know what that means, civil works is more, I actually had it, my notes over here written down, but it's focusing more on the nation's water resources. And so from the environmental side, that's everything from ecosystem restoration to protecting environment, like threatened and endangered species, looking at invasive and nuisance species like invasive fish or plants. And so it was a very different departure for me. And then eventually, kind of like Elizabeth, the associate technical director position came up open. And I was able to kind of get that hands-on experience there and decided that I, too, really enjoyed building teams and building those teams in order to solve these really complex environmental challenges that are facing our waterways. And so eventually I moved into the technical director position, and that's where I've been for the past 5 or 6 years now. So
fabulous. I love your stories. Those are great. Those are great. Our next question. When people hear environmental, they sometimes just think of things like weather, plants, dirt, and bugs. For our listeners, how would you define the overall mission of EL?
I'll hit that one. All right. So this is Elizabeth. So the overall mission of EL, and EL has this really broad, I mean, when you talk about the environment, it is all of those things, right? But it's so much more as well. So their overall mission, you know, in their statement is to be the research and engineering component or superpower of the Army and the Department of War. EL is the only environmental lab within the Department of War. And so they have a huge mission, and there's a lot on their shoulders. So to be that specific lab is a really, really cool mission for them. And so within the EL, that mission goes from, you know, just the bugs and bunnies, yes, but also all the other interactions and complexities that go into working in water and soil and with animals and how those interactions impact our soldiers and our soldier mission, as well as our civil works mission and all the things that have to do with water resources in our nation. And then you've got all of the weather and all the other impacts and all the incoming stressors and challenges into that. So it's this massively complex problem set. And so that's what really makes it so exciting, is you can work on this little tiny aspect of it, like, you know, the microbes that are in the soil, or just look at the soil as some like living microcosm of chemicals and bugs and all sorts of different things. And then you take it up to how that grows a plant.
Right.
And that gets even more complex. So, you know, EL is just an absolutely wonderful place to be because you've got that breadth and complexity.
Right. Yeah. I love your excitement.
And then I will add to that too, is like, then there's kind of parts of it that I think some people don't think about. For instance, on the civil works side, we have a flood risk management and a navigation mission. You know, sitting on the Mississippi River, we see the barges and the ships going up and down the river. Well, there's also an environmental impact or environmental part of that story as well. So how do we make it so that the ships and the commercial navigation can move from point A to point B when we may have either like invasive species or threatened and endangered species present, or if we need to be thinking about, you know, how to dredge in an environmentally responsible way, so that we can ensure that, you know, those commercial activities are not impacted negatively. So it's all of the things.
Right.
So it's not just the bugs and bunnies.
That's right. That's going to be our new slogan, not just the bugs and bunnies.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go with that. Okay. So the theme of our show this season is discovering the power of ERDC 7 Labs united to solve challenges. Can you provide an example of how EL has partnered with another ERDC laboratory to tackle a challenge that neither could have solved alone?
That's always the hardest question, right? Because every problem we have, since I talked about the complexity, are so massive. There isn't a way that you can solve these big challenges alone. And so I can't think of many examples where EL or any of the labs act alone.
Right.
And I think that's why I've stayed at ERDC, right? Because of that interaction and that interdisciplinary thing and the fact that all of the problems that we face are so complex. That's what keeps me and personally interested. And that's what keeps our researchers really engaged as well, because they get to work across the bounds. So examples of that include, you know, some of the major things of material science. So understanding how different critters act with their physiology. So, you know, how a fish actually moves through the water creates engineering models for how we can use underwater drones in the water. So taking the environmental aspect of it, the critter aspect of it, and then transferring it over into some new material or some new shape or some new engineering model so that it becomes something that we use to sense the environment or to sense some adversary or something along those lines. So that pathway crosses across so many different people. It crosses across the information technology laboratory, the geospatial laboratory, the geotechnical laboratory, and all of those folks, the coastal and hydraulics laboratory, all of those players have to come into play just to create something that goes from something that had a biological start to something that we're using out in the field.
Awesome. Jan, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, sure. I'll just add to what Elizabeth was saying in that, I think the power of ERDC, as they say, is the fact that you have so many different disciplines, whether they're scientists or engineers or anything, but all under one roof so that you can, you know, bring all of those forces to bear on a lot of these really, really, really difficult challenges. And it's really exciting as a researcher, like Elizabeth was saying, to be able to work with those folks and like learn while you're, you know, using all of your skills, but then being able to really solve these really complex challenges from a holistic kind of environment is just really exciting. So one of the things I could think of just about everything that we do, like Elizabeth said, I think is kind of cross-functional and requires a wide array of backgrounds. So one of the areas that we work in is natural infrastructure, and that can is really in support of flood risk management or coastal resilience, and but then also things like building oyster reefs and beach dunes and, you know, coastal wetlands. And so that takes all different kinds of backgrounds, whether you're in CHL, you know, you're or in EL, or maybe we're working in cold environments. And so you have to bring in those experts from Corel. But then we're also looking at how do we couple natural infrastructure with maybe more conventional infrastructure like levees and dams, and in order to protect those communities, but then also those natural systems that serve a whole host of benefits. So
awesome.
Yep.
So important. So a key pillar of this season is military engineering. People often forget that in a mission, the environment itself can be a very big obstacle. So how does EL gather complex environmental data like terrain and vegetation mapping and develop it into intelligence tools that our military can use?
Okay, I'll take that one. So we've had so many instances where we've had operational obstacles created by the environment. When we've had soldiers jump into territories that we really didn't quite understand, they've gotten stuck. It's slowed them down. We've had various dangerous wildlife that has actually impacted missions, like say, a venomous snake. And so when we talk to a lot of our soldiers and try and understand, you know, what challenges do we need to solve for them, some of those stories have come out of, you know, oh my gosh, I had to jump in and it was green. It looked like a landing zone, but it really wasn't. It was, you know, triple canopy and none of us could get out of the helicopter. And so we couldn't jump in. They'd already heard us. We lost our mission, and it was mission failure. So that's a really big deal for us. So one of the projects that I'm funding right now is called Intelligent Environmental Battlefield Assessment or Awareness.
I was just going to say, what's the acronym?
AIBA.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, so, you know, it's not the most exciting of the acronyms, but, you know, since it's an Army, we have to use the acronym. And so its stable name is AIBA. And that project is looking at understanding layer by layer what the environment is. So if I spin the globe and put my finger down anywhere on that globe at any time, current or in the future, we will understand what is there, how we can use that environment, and then what types of things can get in our way and how we can get around them. So that could be, you know, very loose soil. It could be permafrost melting. It could be heavy vegetation. All of those things impact how we're actually going to execute our mission. And so being prepared for it, very much to the planning side, or what we would call to the left of boom, is where we need to be. So amazingly enough, we just didn't have those data sets. So we're looking out to academia, to industry, to other federal agencies, finding where people have put together these large data sets. Maybe they're about soil, maybe they're about vegetation, maybe they're about forests, maybe they're about wildlife. But bringing those all together so that they can be there for the planning aspect of the mission and trying to understand where chemicals and industries are, so that we can understand what might get used against us, or what we can use in our fight. Maybe it's something we don't bring with us, but we suddenly start to use.
To use, right.
And so that project is really large, and we're getting into the aspects. We've got all of our static data of understanding where we are right now, and now we're getting into that predictive phase of being able to look out into the future and say, okay, in the next 3 to 5 years, this is what that's going to look like. Do we need to take it further after that? Yeah, probably. But with various changes, you know, it probably is something you'll have to reassess at that point. But yeah, so that's one of the things that we're funding right now.
Okay.
To really help understand what those aspects are that are the most important and make sure that we can use them in our fight.
Okay, great. Jen, do you have anything to add?
No, not really. I mean, that's definitely, I would say, more in Elizabeth's wheelhouse for sure. But I will say that there are a lot of lessons learned that we learn on the civil side and through our research and collaboration with the USACE community that can be applied to military applications, installations, and
it all goes hand in hand.
Yep, engineering solutions. Mm-hmm. So, yep.
Fantastic. As we face challenges like wildfires and water resources, how does EEL ensure that our military installations are secure, sustainable, and ready for future threats?
Yeah, I'll hit that one too. So installations are key to any type of military success, right? That's where our soldiers enter the Army. That's where they live and train. That's where we deploy from, right? So our installations are absolutely key. On the industrial side, that's also where we create most of our explosives and our, you know, everything that we use in operations. So our installations are the linchpin. They're the absolute base to everything that we do. So they have to be sustainable. And a lot of them are very old.
Right.
They are not sort of the part of the fight that comes out in the press that people think of. But they are the absolute basis of our success. So when we're looking at installations, we're trying to figure out how we can make them the most resilient. We're doing some really great research to understand how we can create that resiliency so that we can create sustainable infrastructure, utilize new materials, and be able to create very adaptive and resilient structures with a lot of sustainability thrown in there. So when you look at training ranges in the past were kind of static. One soldier who I might actually be married to, told me that, you know, he would love going to this one training range because he knew where all the targets were, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but he's like, but that's no challenge.
Right.
There's nothing new there.
That's like somebody playing a video game. You know the cheat code, so there's, yeah. You know, why even play it?
Exactly. And so making the training ranges so that they're novel and new, making sure that we can utilize just the smaller amounts of property that we have. So just the acreage itself. And then making sure that as we utilize them, that we can make sure that that the chemicals and the aspects of our training don't get into the environment and create a problem for our neighbors. One of the studies we did a long time ago was on noise on training ranges. It had the most fascinating results. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, build communities around the installations because it's really nice to work, to live close to where you work. Mm-hmm. And our installations are in some really, really nice places sometimes. And so we were looking at, okay, so as people are building houses closer and closer, they were like, oh man, I didn't realize when I built this house that they'd be training at 11 o'clock at night, you know, and there's some big booms mm-hmm. going off with this training or lots of vehicle noise or dust. And so we were like, okay, let's check this out. So we started looking at REM sleep. And we began to understand that as people are in the early parts of their sleep, that the training noise really interrupted their sleep. Mm-hmm. But about 2 a.m., if it was on a normal sleep cycle where you go to bed somewhere around 9, 10, 11.
Not so much.
At 2 a.m., they were no longer bothered by our noise. They were in this deeper sleep, and it didn't bring them out of it. So the noise was less of an impact.
Interesting.
You know, and so the soldiers were not particularly happy with this because, you know, that gives you off from like, you know, 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. Mm-hmm. But then a heavy impact on training later in the night or early morning hours mm-hmm. was less impactful. So different range tools and so on have been created out of those sorts of findings. And then on the actual critter side of the house, trying to understand, like, how does that type of training then impact all the wildlife around?
Right.
Because that's an unusual time for them as well.
Right.
All your night critters like bats
like, what are
and
they
stuff.
Doing?
Yeah. All of a sudden the bats are like, whoa, I'm out here trying to catch my bugs. And you're making explosions. And you know, I like to echolocate my bugs, so your booms are causing my bugs to go in different directions.
Right.
Well, and a lot of those are protected, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be very cognizant of the impacts that you have. And so some of the R&D that we've been able to do that I think kind of crosses the boundaries there is been able to say, okay, well, if we're going to do this testing and we know it's going to have these impacts on these species, like, is there a way for us to understand where those species are? So maybe we can either train in a different area or train at different times of day in order to limit those impacts.
Right.
And so
right.
that way you're maximizing, you know, mission readiness while also working with the environment that is there.
Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. So, okay, so now we're transitioning to Silver Works.
Ooh.
So, EL has been at the forefront of combating harmful agroblooms, HABs, as we will refer to it, that threaten our drinking water and local economies. Can you tell us about these projects and how EL partners with others to scale up these solutions and protect the nation's waterways?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's a really big challenge that I think with time, more and more people are beginning to understand the importance and the significance of harmful algablooms. You know, in the beginning, you heard a lot about them, like in places like Florida or maybe even in the state of Ohio and the Great Lakes area. But since we've been actively researching this topic for the past 5 or 6 years now, more and more information continues to come to light about that really this is a nationwide issue. So what we're doing we're leading it out of my shop under the Aquatic Nuisance Species Research Program. We have quite a robust program at this stage of the game where we're looking at prevention, detection, and management of harmful algal blooms in freshwater systems. And We work really closely with other federal agencies across the nation that also kind of share this mission area. Just like everything else we've been talking about, you know, this is a really hard challenge, and it does pose a real threat to any community's water supply. And so it really just, we have to bring everything to bear to try to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've done a lot of work with strategic partners, whether those are academic partners or state partners, industry, on all of these different types of technologies, whether it's being able to use remote sensing to be able to identify whether or not a harmful algal bloom is in a body of water, so that maybe water resource managers that operate recreational areas mm-hmm. know whether or not to make some really hard decisions about the safety of both the people working, but also those visitors that are coming to those core managed properties. Mm-hmm. We also are trying to be able to detect in water whether or not just because you see algae doesn't mean that it's a harmful algal bloom. There's lots of different types that all kind of look the same. And so trying to figure that out, especially with someone that maybe isn't an expert. So we're trying to come up with tools that really can help inform people about the safety. And then most important, you know, the Corps of Engineers, we manage water resources. And right. So how do we manage those waters that maybe, you know, may have a HAB in them? And what do those decisions look like? How do we manage them? How do we knock them back? And so there's just a lot of considerations that need to be taken into that. So we have, I don't even know, over 40 different projects spanning the range from, you know, very small, kind of almost basic like research of just trying to understand some basic science, all the way up to full scale demonstrations of technology on large bodies of water. So that we can say, hey, look, here is this this management tool that we've researched, and now we're beginning to implement in the field and are getting the data that those end users need to be able to utilize it themselves mm-hmm. so that they can, you know, protect their communities as well. So it's a really, it's a big challenge. It's an important challenge. It requires a lot of communication, but absolutely collaboration is at the heart of what we do there, and no one ERDC lab or one entity could really do it alone. So
and again, just like you say, we hear it now on the news, we hear mm-hmm. it all over the place now.
Yeah.
So Elizabeth, do you have anything to add?
You know, the harmful algal blooms and anything that impacts the community around installations mm-hmm. or around our soldiers is huge, right?
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
the ability to have drinking water anywhere in the world, wherever they might be, is a really big deal. So harmful algal blooms impacts not just our civil work side of the house, but really impacts our military mission as well.
Right, right. Yep. So whether it's dealing with extreme weather, harmful algal blooms, or resilient infrastructure, ERDC takes on massive issues. What is the most complex environmental challenge the EL team is tackling right now that demands the one ERDC multi-lab approach? That's a big question, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll give it from the military side.
Okay.
Because I think you've got some really big challenges on the civil side too. So like I mentioned at the beginning, every challenge that we're facing right now mm-hmm. is really across the board for all the ERDC labs, and really on the military side, all of the Army's labs. And sometimes it's all of DOW's labs, you know, include the Navy and the Air Force labs. Mm-hmm. And other federal agencies as well. So quite honestly, when you're looking at the environment, there's no way that you could have one place that has it all. You know,
right.
Even if it is, you know, the central location of most things environment. So for me on the military side that we can talk about it here, I think it would be the so understanding the vegetation across the globe anytime, anywhere. Because that plays such a central role in how we can actually operate. So vegetation can stop us from actually entering an area. It can impact how we move in an area. It impacts how we work with our drones in a particular area. It can be used for hiding us, or it can be used for hiding our adversaries. Vegetation impacts how communications can be passed, mm-hmm. how our sensors work. So understanding all of that, and then how we can predict what's going to be there and what types of impacts it'll have is a huge, huge problem set. And we've got people working on it from all over the ERDC labs. And I think everybody can kind of see themselves in trying to understand that problem and other federal agencies as well. So that would be one of the ones that I think is just one of those issues that we've got that goes across the board. Because when you're doing predictions, you're going to start using artificial intelligence. You're going to start using some AI, right? Because you're going to start saying, okay, here's what it is now. Here's how these other things have reacted in the past. Now, how do we use AI to bring in and understand what those projections will be? And is that realistic? Does AI give you, you know, the six-fingered person, or does it give you the five-fingered person, right?
Right.
So those are the types of things that you want to try to understand is how do we train some of the prediction models so that we get real accurate answers to what our questions are.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm actually going to answer this question a little bit differently. So one of the things that we're really in a process in a time of change on the civil work side. And one of the big initiatives that we recently started across the Corps is the build infrastructure and not paperwork, which is really kind of changing the landscape of how we operate on the civil work side. And in a lot of ways, a lot of things haven't changed exactly. It's just how we're thinking about them and how we're approaching them. So for instance, there's a lot of focus on like things like cutting red tape. So how do we improve how we make permitting or other decisions for environmental compliance so that we can move more quickly on initiating new infrastructure builds, and also things like dredging, for instance, which is when the Corps comes in, or companies that work with the Corps that maintain like shipping channels and things like that for navigation. So how do we be able to dredge in a way when we have maybe some environmental compliance considerations like threatened and endangered species or sensitive habitats, right? So how can we use data to determine and maximize those efficiencies so that we can do more under tighter timelines and, you know, save those resources so we can utilize them in other places? So really we're focusing a lot on efficiency, but also transparency and accountability. And so really we're in the process where we're overhauling really our entire regulatory and permitting process to eliminate those delays, and then also provide like consistent decision-making nationwide so that a regulator in the Pacific Northwest is approaching a situation similar to someone that maybe is in the southeast of the country. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of thought going into that right now and how we do that. And we're bringing a lot of multidisciplinary teams together to try to, you know, create these tools that we need in order to streamline these processes and meet these new initiatives, which I think are really important for the Corps of Engineers. So, I think in a way it's just an updated way of thinking how to meet these mission objectives under more expedited and urgent timelines.
Okay, great. So we're wrapping up. Can you believe it?
I know.
I told you guys it was going to be so super fast. So looking ahead, are there any key takeaways that you want our listeners to understand about the importance of the work being done at EL? Another fun question.
You want me to get started on that?
Okay. Yes.
So I think the thing that is really important to me is that we're creating some really excellent solutions to challenges and problems that our communities, our soldiers, our civil works missions are facing. We don't do it alone. There are so many different types of expertise within the environmental laboratory, from soils to critters to air to water, you know, everything in between, from the tiniest little organisms up to, you know, flocks of birds. There's expertise there, but we can't answer these really complex challenges alone. We utilize the breadth of the ERDC. We use the breadth of all of our sister labs throughout the services and throughout the federal government, state governments, wherever we can find them. Mm-hmm. And so that partnership and dealing with those massive, complex problems, I think, is really key for what the environmental lab looks at. And it's what I think makes people happy to work at the environmental lab.
Right.
Yeah, no, I'll add in that, kind of go back to something that Elizabeth brought up earlier, in this as well. It's like we just work together across the board, and we're not doing environmental work for the sake of doing environmental work. It's there is always a reason or a question that's being asked that we really are diving in and creating these solutions or gathering this data so that we can help the mission delivery, whether that's on the military side or focused on our, you know, protection of our internal mission and water resources and flood risk management, aquatic ecosystem restoration, navigation, you name it, natural resource management. So it's just really important that we continue to do this work so that we can continue to deliver our mission. And it is really, really fun to get to do what we do and to work across the board. And the fact that ERDC and the Environmental Lab serve a very unique mission across the DOW portfolio, I think is something that I think not a lot of people really are cognizant of. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember.
Great. Well, ladies, thank you guys so much for being here. I've really enjoyed it and learning about the Environmental Lab. So again, we have been speaking with two guests today, Dr. Elizabeth Ferguson. She's the lead technical director, installations and operational environments, senior scientific manager, and Dr. Jen Sider-Mosier. She's technical director, civil works, senior scientific technical manager at EL. So ladies, I just want to say this. I say this almost every radio show. You can't teach passion, and you ladies are very passionate about what you do, and it shows, and people I know can hear it, the listeners can hear it. But another thing I want to do is thank you guys for what you do for the community, for the region, and for the nation. It's so very, very important. So again, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks. That was fun.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to Beyond the Gates. I'm Annette Kirkland, and we'll come back at you next week. Have a great one.